You are listening to the Gay Florida Man Podcast. This podcast is hosted by retired corrections officer Mark DeWolf, who will discuss various topics prevalent to corrections, gay culture, arts and entertainment, as well as current events. Listeners need to be advised that this podcast will discuss situations involving extreme violence, substance abuse, sexual assault, and murder. Details of actual events have been modified so as to protect the privacy of involved parties.
Welcome back to the Gay Florida Man. This is episode 15. Now, before we dive into what we're doing for today's podcast, I wanted to do a couple of shout outs to a couple of amazing people. The first one would be my good, dear friend, Dulcie. She's been having a really hard time the last little while, and she wrote me the most amazing private message about how much she appreciates this podcast. And I just wanted to shout out and say, Dulcie, I love you. You sent me the absolute best message, and I'm sorry that you're going through what you're going through right now. But you're not alone. I'm thinking about you, and I just want you to know you're amazing. The other one that I would like to shout out to is Mara. She followed me on Instagram, and I followed her back, and I got some inside information that I didn't follow her fast enough, and she thought I was kind of an asshole about not following her fast enough. I apologize, Mara. I think you rock, and I hope to see more posts on Instagram from you. We're going to be doing a new series. Robbie and I, who love horror movies, even though we are completely gay, we're going to be doing horror movie essentials. And essentially what that means is, because I collect movie props and wardrobe from various horror movies, we're going to start to do a podcast relating to a movie that I have a prop or piece of wardrobe from. We're going to start to do this as a series to cover everything in my collection, because I'm basically a hoarder of horror movie shit. My house is filled. There is props and wardrobe everywhere. And I know certain friends come here and they freak out and they're like, I don't know how you live in that house. That shit's scary and creepy. What the fuck's wrong with you? Without further ado, let's get the ball rolling. Tonight, we are going to be talking about the 1990 film Misery. So joining me once again is my horror movie friend. Please welcome Robbie.
Hello, hello.
Welcome back, Robbie. We're going to be talking about a movie you and I both love, Misery, 1990.
Yes, please.
I know that this is a film that you absolutely love, because I know that we've talked about it in the past, and you said, oh, you love Misery. Kathy Bates, James Caan, just a fantastic film. Misery is not the first film actually directed by Rob Reiner, because he had done, as far as Stephen King work, he had actually done Stand By Me. Stephen King was really kind of impressed by what he did with Stand By Me, was a little bit hesitant about putting Misery on the big screen, but then when he found out that Rob Reiner was involved, he agreed. He agreed to Misery to make it to the big screen.
So that's incredible. I had no idea. I actually didn't know Rob Reiner directed that.
Do you know who Rob Reiner was? I mean, other than a director, do you know about his background in acting?
I've seen him in something. I'm not sure. He's a little bit heavier set. What was he in? What have I seen?
This would have been way before your time, but he was in a television show called All in the Family. And he was the son-in-law. Sally Struthers was married to him in that television show, and the nickname was Meathead. And it was kind of a very popular show many, many years ago before your time. But that's where a lot of people remember Rob Reiner from, not so much his work as a director. But he's still a great director. I mean, Stand By Me, he was fantastic. He had not done a horror movie before, and was very interested in doing Misery. And he brought on William Goldman to actually write the screenplay for Misery. And it was William Goldman who had suggested Kathy Bates for the role.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, it's funny. I'm going to tell you some of the other names that were thrown around. Now, William Goldman, he insists that it was always Kathy Bates. There was no other considerations. But I'm reading online, I'm seeing a whole bunch of other actresses that were considered for the part of Annie Wilkes. And if you just think about these different people and tell me what you think about them playing that part, because it's a very physical part. Bette Midler, Angelica Houston, Jessica Lange, Barbara Streisand, Mary Tyler Moore actually wanted the part from what I was reading, Roseanne Barr, or Rosie O'Donnell.
Holy shit.
Now, I don't know about Mary Tyler Moore, but I know that like with some of these other people, like especially Roseanne Barr, Rosie O'Donnell, they fit kind of like the perception of the way that what Stephen King pictured Annie Wilkes to look like.
Yes.
You know, like a farm girl, a full-figured farm girl that could handle her own.
Correct. That, and when you said Jessica Lange, I really, really love Jessica Lange. Of course, I was first introduced to her from American Horror Story. But since watching that, I've looked at some of her older films or her previous films. And she is an incredible actress. And she gives so much of herself into the role and puts her all into it. So I think that she would have been a contender. She definitely would have been more on the frail side of things because she's always been this petite actress. And I love me some Rosie O'Donnell and Roseanne. I really, really do. Those are two. I know there's a lot of controversy surrounding both of them for the most part. I think they both can hold their own, especially in a role like that. Honestly, Kathy Bates, it'd be hard to I don't know, like, don't fuck with perfection. It's hard to think about anything otherwise.
Big shoes to fill for that role of Annie Wilkes. You know, as I was reading about how Stephen King kind of put that character together, wrote that book, it's based loosely on a real-life serial killer, Janine Jones, who was a nurse who was believed to have killed over 60 children, but only actually confirmed to have killed two. And I think she's still alive in Texas, in a Texas prison. That's an interesting case. I'm not going to go into that right now because we're talking about Misery. But that's kind of one of the influences for the character of Annie Wilkes in Misery. But it's kind of cool. It's also interesting that on the collector's edition DVD of Misery, a forensic psychologist described Annie Wilkes as a virtual catalog of mental illness. Because there are certain traits from different mental illnesses that Kathy Bates displays in Misery. And so you can't really classify her as schizophrenic or bipolar. There's so many different traits that she's giving off. And so they couldn't classify it as one. He says, this bitch is crazy. So it's fantastic. He did such a great job developing that character. Now, for the part of Paul Sheldon, our author, the whole list, and I'm going to go down this list. This is going to take a second. But there is a lot of people that were considered for this part. Some more interested than others. Like Dustin Hoffman is one, and he didn't like it because of the violence. But here's the other people that they talked about as far as casting this part. Jack Nicholson, similar to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yep.
He was terrorized by a nurse, and so it's very similar, but he had already done another Stephen King adaptation. Robert De Niro, Warren Beatty, Bill Murray, Michael Douglas, Richard Dreyfuss, who was also in Stand By Me, Harrison Ford. Now, that would have been an interesting one. Morgan Freeman. That would have been really, really fascinating to see how that would have played out. Mel Gibson, Gene Hackman, Jeff Daniels, William Hurt, Kevin Kline, Al Pacino, Robert Redford, Denzel Washington, or Bruce Willis. Now, I guess a lot of these people turned down the part or showed no interest. And so I'm just trying to think of like the standpoint of James Caan. You know, okay, we're going to give you this part, but we've offered it to all of Hollywood. Nobody wanted it. Will you take it? Right? I mean, how does that play into James Caan? I don't know if he would have like felt very good about that, but James Caan did a fantastic role. And you probably would agree that I couldn't picture anybody else in the part.
I completely agree. I just watched this recently with a really good friend of mine named Tyler. He had never seen it before. He's very much, I kind of have to drag him or introduce him into older films that he's never had an interest in or never been exposed to, that he'd never seen Misery.
How old is he?
He is 35.
Okay.
When he was watching it, the first thing that what he made the connection was that James Caan in Elf as the father. Right. Of course, making that connection, it's such a stretch between the characters. But I feel as though that, again, it's hard to see anybody else in that role. I don't know if it's because I hold Kathy Bates extremely high with some of the greatest actresses of all time. It's hard to almost put somebody else in her place, because like you said, it's filling some really big shoes. But with James Caan, I feel as though I don't know enough about him to say, oh, you know, there was no one else that could have done his job. But the role that he played and the acting and the outcome of everything was absolutely incredible. And his just watching it recently and seeing the pain that he's depicting through this entire process or ordeal sure. that he's in, there's no shortage of either, in my opinion, overacting or underacting. I think it's absolutely fucking perfect is what the job that he does. In that list, it's interesting because it wasn't Denzel. Who was the... Yeah, no, Denzel Washington.
The other African-American actor was Morgan Freeman that they'd considered. The source for all of this information is... I look at several different sources online, and I also look at different interviews that the actors, the director, the producer on YouTube. And so looking at all the different areas on the internet, which is great because the internet never lies. It's 100% true. All these different names are thrown out on different sources on the internet as actors that were up for the role of Paul Sheldon.
And Denzel is one. Immediately when you said his name, I thought back to his other film where he was bedridden, Angelina Jolie in it. She was the detective.
I don't think I've seen this one.
Oh my gosh. His character is, I believe, paralyzed from the waist down. I'm not sure if he's like a criminologist or he studies or researches or basically helps the police department remotely from his, like, his loft. His caretaker is Queen Latifah. He meets Angelina Jolie, who is an up-and-coming detective. And he, anyways, through the entire film, which is, it's so damn good, is kind of solving this murder, helping to solve this murder from the clues that are being left behind by this notorious killer that they can't seem to catch. But he's bedridden the entire time, and he does the concept of somebody who is stuck in a bed trying to do everything they can, and at one point in the movie, he is attacked, and you see the pain, you see the grimace on his face, the perspiration, the desperation of wanting to, you know, fight or get out of there or whatever it may be, but being limited in his mobility. I could honestly see him in the role of James Caan. What's done is done, and you can't fuck with perfection. Like, that movie is perfect.
Here it is, Robbie. Bone Collector, 1999. Denzel Washington, Angelina Jolie, Queen Latifah, Michael Rooker. Just like so many other films we talked about, the list goes on and on and on with all the amazing talent. Yeah, I'm going to have to visit this one because I don't think I've ever seen it. One of the things that you brought up is the whole position of our lead actor being in that bed essentially through the whole movie, other than him escaping out of that bedroom. The way that Stephen King wrote the book is that whole thing of him being stuck. There was a time period where Stephen King went through a drug problem, and the whole story of Misery kind of is a parallel to his addiction to drugs and how Annie Wilkes is kind of like drugs to him. Annie Wilkes represents, and I'm reading this right from the website, Annie Wilkes represents his depending on drugs and what it did to his body, feeling alone and separated from everything. And this is a quote from him. Annie was my drug problem. She was my number one fan. And so that's interesting how he kind of used his own substance abuse when he was writing this story. And a lot of what happened to him kind of parallels in the book. It didn't really come across in the movie, but how Paul Sheldon gets addicted to those pain medications that Annie's given him. In the book, it goes a lot more in depth with that. In the movie, it was kind of just, you know, lightly put in, sprinkled into the film.
Holy shit.
Yeah, kind of interesting when you start to talk about where these writers come up with these ideas and these stories, and it's amazing. And of course, Stephen King, he's produced so many amazing stories and books. To get inside his mind, I don't know if I would even want to venture there. It's probably pretty terrifying. He's a great writer.
Oh my God. I would pay good money to get inside his mind. I think it's just pure genius. I think his stories are incredibly well thought out. They do definitely touch, I don't want to say sensitive topics, but definitely some topics that are a little bit more skirted around by a lot of people, or at least people at that time. And he kind of brought them to light, which is kind of crazy to think about. Since you told me that, it gives a deeper meaning to the movie,
mm-hmm.
with somebody associating being stuck, being a hostage almost, mm-hmm. to someone or something at this point,
mm-hmm.
and trying to get away, but still there's that, it's not letting the escape easy. It's definitely putting up its own fight. So that's fucking awesome. I really that.
It's cool. As we look at the story, we probably should tell everybody at this point, there's spoilers that we're going to be talking about. I think at this point, if you have not seen Misery, you had to have been born within the last week. Because Misery is, you know, I'm sure The Simpsons have made fun of it. I'm sure Family Guy's made fun of it. I know that it's referred to. I know Kathy Bates, as much as she loved that part and as much as it has opened doors for her, there was a few interviews where she's like, I'm good on just, you know, moving forward and not continuing to talk about that one part of Annie Wilkes. She's over the whole fame from Misery. It did a lot for her and her career.
And I could only imagine.
She had said that was like the first time she had her own trailer, and she remembers it and she describes it very, very well. But she also said it was very lonely sitting in her trailer. So she hung out on the set because she just got tired of sitting in her trailer, which I don't blame her. You got this great story. And so you've got this great writer, and he does these Misery books, these love novels. And I saw in an interview where James Caan was talking to this one particular interviewer, and she said that for her, the biggest problem she had with the movie is that he drank one glass of the Dom Perignon and left the rest of the bottle in the room. And what she asked him, what kind of guy does that? And I thought James Caan's response was excellent, because he said, a very rich guy. Why wouldn't you bring the rest of the bottle? It's Dom Perignon. It's like the newest bottle you can get, it's $200 a bottle. So for her, that was like the biggest mistake or the biggest he had with the whole movie. You got James Caan, and he is playing the part of Paul Sheldon. And so he's done this long series of love novels about Misery Chastain. Final story has been sent to the publisher. It's on the verge of getting published. And he's got this new manuscript, and he finishes the manuscript. He has this process he goes through with the Dom Perignon and the one cigarette. He used to be a cigarette smoker. And then he gets in his Mustang and he goes out into this snowstorm, and he's driving along. And as you already know, he has this horrible fucking accident. And I'm sure a Mustang, a 66 Mustang in a snowstorm, completely sucks shit. I don't know why anybody would do that. He must have been hitting hard liquor before he had the Dom Perignon. And he gets rescued by this former nurse, Annie Wilkes. And she brings him back to the cabin, and she nurses him back to health. And in the process, you start to realize that she is the craziest fucking bitch you've ever seen since Fatal Attraction.
I was literally about to say since Glenn Close.
Yeah,
fucking incredible.
Yes. Can you imagine those two duking it out?
I would.
In mixed martial arts.
God, somebody make this movie now.
Right. It's such a great film. He's incapacitated. His legs are, they're mush. And he's in the bed. He's totally stuck in this situation. He can go nowhere. He can do nothing. He's totally dependent upon Annie Wilkes. She knows a little bit about him. She's a big fan. She's the number one fan. She realizes that he was up there writing this last book, and manipulates him into letting her read that copy of the newest novel. Him being just totally thankful for this woman saving his life, said, yes, of course you can read it, not realizing how obsessed she was, and he was about to majorly trigger her. Then everything goes off the rails. We are all sitting in the movie theater watching this roller coaster, and it's a blast. It was such a fun movie. When did you first see it, Robbie?
I had to have been, I'm 32 now. I was probably 13 or 14 years old when I first watched it.
And it was at the suggestion of your mother.
Correct. Yeah. My mom, awesome. In the past podcast, I said that my mom was a huge horror fan and loved my mom. I got my love of Stephen King from my mother. And we originally watched Dolores Claiborne, another Stephen King novel that was made into a movie. She brought to my attention that there was another film with Kathy Bates in it. That was another Stephen King novel, and it was Misery. When I first watched it, I had to turn my head, aka my mom put my hand in front of her, my eyes. Sledgehammer and like a 4x4 in between the ankles scene.
I think that for most people, that is the scene. And it's crazy because, like, other than that, there's the fight scene at the end, which there's a little bit of blood. But it's really not that bloody of a movie.
Oh, no. Mm-mm.
There was no blood when she does that to his ankles. You know, you saw just enough to jump out of your seat and cringe.
Yes. I have the hardest time watching bones break. In film, in real life, I don't know what it is. I can see a zombie eating somebody's heart directly out of the chest cavity just fine. God forbid somebody snaps a finger on film, or I cannot handle it. So I have to legitimately turn my head away when she got the sledgehammer. Yeah, it was.
Robbie, you're not alone. Zombie eating brains, I'm totally fine. But there's something about a bone breaking, like a compound fracture or fingernails getting bent backwards, that makes me just cringe.
Yes. Okay, I feel better now.
Yeah, you're not alone. That's a pretty good. And I think that probably as they developed this screenplay, they probably knew, because in the book, she actually cuts off either one or two of his feet. I never read the novel. Did you?
No, I didn't. Okay. I own it, but I have a collection of all of his books, but I've only read maybe a third of them.
Okay. Her character is a lot more sadistic in the book. And I know that we could go all day saying, well, the book said this and the movie didn't show this. And I can't stand those conversations. Like, let's just talk about the movie.
Correct.
But I will just say that it was a lot more extreme. And I think that they realized that was probably not going to present well on film, having her cut off his feet. It was probably going to be too much, or maybe so extreme that people would laugh. But I think the way they did it with the sledgehammer and the 4x4, like you said, it just was done so well. Kudos to Rob Reiner. That was fantastic.
I couldn't even imagine having Rob Reiner come to me and say, so there's going to be a scene where you're going to put a piece of wood between James Caan's ankles. You're going to grab a sledgehammer and basically shatter both of his fucking ankles. Yeah, we're shooting that tonight. So, you know, I don't.
Do you remember what she called the operation or the procedure?
Was it hobbling? Or
you got it. Yep.
It was. Yay.
From the diamond mines. Yep. Absolutely. Yes. Yep. Kudos to you. That's
fucking
great.
Terrible. God.
Yeah, it is terrible. But it was great. And it really helped make that movie. She was a total bitch, and it made you hate her so much.
I have to jut in with that. So it was so, of course you see her and then you start to learn that she's just a fucking psychopath. She is completely unhinged. You know, whatever she has set her mind on, she's going to do it. It's terrifying, but at the same time, there's this little part of you, or at least of me watching it, where there, I felt sad for her, because I felt as though this is somebody that, if they sought help, this wasn't a monster. This wasn't some bloodthirsty killer. This was somebody who was unhinged, possibly because of something in their past that they never sought help. They never, you know, reached out to get the services that they needed. But all of this led to unhealthy is a understatement, of course, but a very unhealthy obsession over a man, an author, a celebrity, I guess you could say, which has led people, of course, not to be too real, but in history of assassinating or shooting or murdering people because they have it in their head that they've made a reality that involves somebody that they are so enamored with that they'll do anything. And sometimes that anything is murder. Or
Selena, was she murdered? Was that over celebrity, or I'm thinking of somebody different?
Yes, it is. Oh my God, you're opening up a fucking can of worms.
Okay, sorry.
No, you're not. I'm Mexican, so Selena is like straight up right out of my heart. That was a manager, mm-hmm. But the manager was her number one fan.
Oh God,
who did anything that she could to be close to Selena, and then when it came down to things, the manager was also stealing money and items and holding them like ransom. And then when they confronted her about it, Selena did, the family did, but then Selena went to her, like her hotel room to basically have a one-on-one with her, and she shot her in the back. She loved her so much that she couldn't stand Selena being mad at her. So she shot her. I don't know.
Another very, very high profile case would be Ronald Reagan. And John Hinckley trying to impress Jodie Foster by killing the president.
Yes. I mean, yes.
Very, very unhinged. When you talk about motivation, and I wanted to bring this up before we get too far off the topic, you talk about the background of Annie Wilkes, and we've already said that she had a whole slew of mental illness. She was completely crazy. Again, this is another thing that I was reading about today. Kathy Bates going to the director and talking about the motivation of this character because she is really crazy. And they had come to an agreement that Annie Wilkes had been molested by her father. And so a lot of your mental illness is because of the trauma that she experienced as a child.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, as far as like you were talking about motivation, what makes somebody do these crazy things? And it's because of the trauma in her own background. As a nurse, she had that scrapbook with all the newspaper clippings of all the babies that she killed.
Yeah, and scrapbook makes it seem like it's some Martha Stewart shit, but no, that was like a catalog of her past fucking moments of like just her going off the rails, and she's in the fact that she was basically being published or being heard of or being found. She saw that as a trophy. She saw that as something to keep and hold on and remember. You know, normally you'd be like, I don't want to be affiliated with my history of murdering babies or these people, this, you know, medical fucked up shit that I've done. I think I want to run away from that. No, she was very proud of it. She was,
you're right,
she had it in a fucking, you know, scrapbook, you know?
Yeah, that's really sad. That's really sad. One of the things about Annie Wilkes that I love about this movie, and it's something I keyed in on the first time I saw it. And when I saw it, I was working in a movie theater. I was working in Tyson's Corner, Virginia. And it's probably the favorite job I've ever had since I started working. We used to stay late at night, Robbie. And certain movies, we would have our own private screening with just the staff that was working there and the projectionist. He would stay late and he'd come down and we watch movies and eat popcorn and drink soda. And so we had no idea the roller coaster ride that Misery was going to turn out to be. And I remember sitting in the theater, and I think it was theater number 3. And it was just, I don't know, there was like less than 10 of us watching this movie. And it was absolutely awesome. We were quoting the movie. We were talking about it for months. When it finally came out on video, got to go rent it, got to watch it again over and over. Just an amazing, amazing movie.
Not to kind of side note, after I watched Misery, I fell in love with it. So I always had it in kind of like just on the back burner in my mind. Of course, I love Stephen King. So I don't know if you're aware, but there was, I think I might have mentioned it to you previously a while ago, was, I guess, a series called Castle Rock that has 2 seasons. If there is another season coming, it's been a while, so I don't know if they will. Castle Rock takes place in the realm of Stephen King's universe. All of his books and novels and characters and locations and all of these things all intermix because all of the settings are normally within Maine. The second season, again, spoiler, everybody, okay? Calm down, everybody. In the second season, the main storyline that is up front and center is Annie Wilkes' past, her upbringing, and where, how she got to where she is. The lead role is from, I don't know the actress's name, but if there's homos listening out there, or at this point, mostly girls or young women, in the movie Mean Girls, the actress that plays Janice Ian, the kind of goth girl that's best friends with Lindsay Lohan, she portrays a young Annie Wilkes, which at first when I saw the previews, I'd heard about articles coming out that she was going to be doing this role, and it made me almost cringe at the fact that they're giving this role, this iconic, again, big shoes to fill role to this one time, in my opinion, at the time, one time actress like that did a decent job in some teen movie. But watching the series, I could not have chosen anyone else, and I would tell everybody else to fuck off if they even said that they could do a better job than what this actress did portraying Annie Wilkes in her younger years. Mm. And even Kathy Bates, I don't know if it was tweeted, I'm sure that's what it was, but nonetheless gave some kind of statement to the media saying she was completely blown away at the actress's portrayal of her character, her iconic character, in this series. And if I highly suggest, if you haven't seen it, Mark, or anybody else, fucking watch Misery. I would definitely suggest Misery first.
Okay.
And then, of course, like I said, it's a second season of the series, but you are very much introduced to multiple, not only Misery, Misery Chastain, or in this case, Annie Wilkes, but also various movies, if you're familiar with more Stephen King stories or novels. They have so many different connections with it. It's fucking incredible. I was extremely annoying to my husband when we were watching it because he could give less of a shit about these movies. And I was basically throwing pillows at his face every time they mentioned something that was related to some other fucking movie or novel. And anyways, I'm sorry, Kurt. I know you're listening to this, but I apologize for that, and I'm sure you're aware.
He's like, yeah, I was there. I live that. And I couldn't enjoy the movie because my husband kept wanting to talk about
God damn details. It. Yes. I was pausing it every fucking 2 minutes.
He was nerding out. And I'm like, can we watch the movie, please? That's great. But what I was getting to, though, is there's an element to Annie Wilkes that I love. And we've talked about this in the other podcast in reference to another movie, another favorite of mine that we talked about when we had our three-way. And so there is an element to Annie Wilkes that is in the background of Misery. And I just love the fact that this particular person, this character, is in the background and you can hear it and you can see it. Do you know what I'm referring to?
No.
She loves Liberace.
Oh my God. That is right.
Yeah. She has his picture in the background and you hear the music playing. She loves to have it playing. And I'm like, how creepy is this bitch?
Full circle, you love Liberace, so I just want to make you aware of how you feel about, you know, Annie Wilkes is how I feel about your obsession with Liberace.
Okay, so now let me, now who is creepier, honestly, Robbie, because I am your number one fan. Would it be me, or would it be
Annie Wilkes? Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I have the phone's ringing, so I gotta go.
Hey, why did you get up at 3 a.m. last night, being underneath that cramped bed?
I knew it. I thought
I knew it. So yeah, the fact that she loves Liberace, I thought that was great because it just made her that much more crazier. Not saying that there's anything wrong with Liberace, but it's just the fact that her character was so unhinged and then she listens to Liberace. It's just like, God, he did, Stephen King did such an amazing job of establishing this character. He thought about every angle. And then even from the fact that it went from a book into a film, God damn, they captured her. They did such a great job.
I loved the fact that she was so, she had her cross around her neck on her necklace, and she, her verbiage was so modest, or even when she, apart from her freakouts, her like her mental breaks, mm-hmm. her swear words or her cuss words were the most, of course, growing up in Utah, people can't even say hell, they'll say heck.
Yeah.
So I love that her go-to was like cock-a-doody. And
yeah, yeah.
And she would never, ever say anything bad. Then fast forward to her blowing a goddamn hole through a sheriff's chest with a shotgun at point-blank range. And she's still not going to say damn or fuck or shit. It was so odd to see that someone that is so conscious of her moral, like this higher ground, but yet she can murder and not blink an eye, and torture and not blink an eye, or and threaten and not blink an eye, and still be so sincere and so just quiet and mousy and still delicate. And you're like, she's fucked up. Like, she
yeah.
is,
yeah.
you know, normally psychopaths aren't scared to, all these killers, they're not going to tiptoe around a bad word, you know, but she's definitely going to do just that. Oh, yeah. Fuck, man.
Well, you know, and that's the thing is, it's funny you'd bring up the swearing, because that's the first thing that she confronts Paul when she's feeding him with the soup. And she has something that's bothering her as he's given her permission to read the new novel. He's like, what's wrong? And she's like, no, who am I to criticize you? You know, you're the accomplished. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, what is it? Please, you know, I want to hear your feedback. And it's the swearing, Paul. It has no nobility. And that was the line. And then he tries to say, well, they're slum kids. I was a slum kid. And that triggers her. That triggers her bad. And that's when she starts to use her own, say, Utah profanity back at him, when she starts saying that, what, you know, do you think I go down to the feed store and I go into the bank? And she starts using all these other, her version of profanity. At least
just out of context. Yeah. The kind of weirdest. Yeah.
Yeah. And she gets so upset, and then she spills the soup, and she's like, now look what you made me do. And that's your first indicator when you see her get triggered, and you're like, oh, that's when you realize Paul's in trouble, and he sees it. And when they do that one shot of James Caan's face, and he realizes he's completely vulnerable to Annie Wilkes.
Yes.
And she is showing signs of instability, and you can see the panic, like, oh, fuck.
I couldn't agree more, especially when he gets there and I think he sees that he has this number one fan
yeah.
who has been nursing him and taking care of him, basically being there for every whim of his, that it suddenly turns at that moment, and he raises his hand above his face when she grabs the chair or the stool or whatever. I think it finally sets in that the celebrity is gone. He is now a victim. He is now completely helpless against this person, this woman. I love seeing that set in, because then you start seeing he's trying to figure what route to take. He tries flattering her. He tries, you know, he does different things. And I think he's trying to figure it out and see where she stands. She's not an idiot either. She plays off as simple, her hog misery and all of the stuff. So you kind of think this is just some obsessed farm woman who, you know, in this podunk little town, and, you know, I just got to get out of here and trick her. But she's not a fucking idiot. She knows exactly what she's doing. He is basically holding a already shattered vase in his hands. And everything that he does, he has to be so fucking delicate with what he says, because at any moment, she could just fly off the goddamn handle, do something to him. And it's scary. That's scary in itself, is not knowing when you're going to trigger somebody that is capable of so much violence and so much anger. And you know, and you're at the mercy of this person.
You're absolutely right. And the thing is like Paul Sheldon, his arrogance that he automatically assumes that he's smarter than her. He can outsmart her. He gets out of the room. He's going to get himself out of this situation. But unfortunately, his arrogance gets the best of him because he doesn't realize that she is not a stupid lady.
Correct.
She's psychotic, but she's also intelligent. There's a shot 19 minutes into the film, Robbie, and I don't know if you remember this, but it's that realization because up to that point, the roads are blocked because of the snowstorm. You know, the phone lines are down. They can't be fixed. He's stuck, but don't worry. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to nurse these legs back to health. I've got plenty of medication. You're fine. 19 minutes in, the sheriff is looking, and I think that he found the car or he was looking, and she's driving down the road, but you don't realize because they shoot from the hood of a car as it's driving along and the sheriff's on the side of the road. And you see all the snow and the camera does a 180 as the camera turns, as it follows the sheriff, as the car is driving by. And then you realize it's exposed that Annie Wilkes is driving the Jeep and that the roads are clear.
Correct.
But it's such an amazing shot, and it's a shot that is actually mentioned on IMDb because it's such a great shot from the cinematographer that was working on the movie. And everybody talks about impressive shots, and in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's when the one character starts to walk into the farmhouse, the camera goes under that swing, and it follows her up to the farmhouse, and that is a shot that even Steven Spielberg noticed. Because as they moved the camera, two people had to grab the bench and lift it up so it would not hit the camera. And it's an amazing shot. For Misery, I'm referring to this shot where it's exposed that Annie Wilkes is driving the Jeep into town. The roads are clear. And you realize that Paul Sheldon could be transported by an ambulance. And now Annie's just not going to let him go.
It's funny that you bring that shot up because I remember watching it recently, noticing that in her, she pulled him from the wreckage when he crashed, when he slid off the road and crashed. She knew exactly what that sheriff was looking at. And yeah. Normally, if somebody has done something in her place, and it's done something like what she's done, and taking his body, and she's literally holding him hostage already, he doesn't really understand at this point how dangerous things are going to get. But nonetheless, she has not reported. She's been lying already. And she doesn't even bat a fucking eye or look. I waited for her to look in the rearview mirror.
Yep.
She doesn't even fucking,
she doesn't look over her shoulder. She doesn't look in the rearview mirror. She's just driving, looking straight ahead, and she looks meaner than fuck.
She's almost satisfied. She's almost nobody. Yeah. And then on top of that, when the fucking sheriff says he's in the helicopter flying over and he's pointing out these areas and he looks at the Wilkes farm, doesn't look like a Mustang to me or whatever.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I thought she has made it so that way they cannot figure this out. I don't know. It's almost like she has been planning this for God knows how long. And okay, again, sorry, fuck, I keep going on because I'm thinking, I always think about like how he tries to escape through the back door, through the kitchen.
Yeah.
And his chair will not let him go through. So of course, me being an overthinker, I think, did she know that the thing can't go past the doors into the kitchen? Like, did she plan that and know that he can't escape that way? And did she purposely make sure that the basement door blended in so fucking well it was almost hidden because the sheriff had a hard time looking for it when he heard him screaming from the basement? All I kept on thinking was that she has probably done this before. She's gotten away with so much in the past. She's made sure that she's done her research and the work to make sure she gets away with things.
You know, and Robbie, I don't know if those details are exposed in the novel, because the novel, of course, always goes into so much more detail. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if they talk about that at all, because I know that, like, there was one scene that they said was cut from the movie where Annie Wilkes runs over a deputy with a lawnmower. and kills this other deputy. Kathy Bates was disappointed that did not get put into the film. I don't know how it would have incorporated into the movie, because it does seem like it's extremely graphic with lots of blood, but she was disappointed. There is a certain amount of me that there's an interest to see how that was done or how that was filmed, because it seems so extreme. Breaking the ankle is one thing, but running a guy over with a lawnmower, that's much more in tune with the character in the book than the screenplay.
I love your disgusting mind, because I would love to see that as well, at least just to see if it fits, because I've seen films where they cut scenes because they look forced, or they look like they're unrelated, or they're kind of like a desperate, weird little side note where the director's like, let's try this. But nonetheless, I would love to see a side of that where you're thinking, fuck, like I've seen deleted scenes where you're like, that totally could have went in there, and it would have added, in my opinion, to the story or whatever, the plot or whatever it may be. I would have loved to see that, as well as even when she was on the road for 2 seconds, I remember watching and think she's going to flip a bitch and run down the cop, the sheriff, because they're already poking. She already knows that they're poking their noses where it shouldn't belong, really. But I don't know what was chillier, is that she was not even bloodthirsty. She was just willing to start fucking taking people out of the equation that were getting too close to finding out what she had done. If that's scarier, or the fact that she was just like, yeah, go ahead. Look, try to find something.
The buildup of the movie as it slowly progresses and you see her becoming crazier, or you at least see that it's being exposed more. I'll never forget when she had the handgun, she has the robe on and she has the gun in the robe. And she says she has this gun, she might put bullets in it. And she has this empty, despondent face. And I'm going to tell you, Robbie, working 20 years in the state prison, 7 of those years was in the mental health unit. I have seen that look on a human being's face. And I will tell you, it's not a good feeling to see it. It's a person you have to fucking be careful. Kathy Bates did an amazing job. I've seen that look before, and it makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. It's not a good feeling.
That I could only imagine, because I remember, again, watching it recently, I feel like I noticed a hell of a lot more. And when it's raining right before she goes south.
Yep.
And you see it in her face. And it's not like, at first you think, oh, you know, everybody's like, Garfield, I hate Mondays kind of thing. But hers is like, she's like advanced. She's just, it's almost like, instead of like, yeah, sometimes when it's overcast, it affects my mood. No, I'm done. Like I'm ready to go, and I'm taking you with me.
Yeah. At that point, there was still hope that he would be able to get out of the situation. And that's when she starts to go into, you know, things are changing, you're getting better, you'll be gone soon. And he tries to lead her to believe, like, no, we're friends now. You know, you've helped me. And
I like it here. Yeah.
She knows that's not true, that this is going to come to an end. And I'm sure if you really want to look at her character, at that point, she's trying to think of ways to keep Paul Sheldon her captive.
Mm-hmm.
So creepy. I gotta sidetrack real quick. We had talked. So I actually met James Caan at the Salt Lake International Airport. I really shouldn't say met. What happened was, is many moons ago, I was going in or coming out, I guess. Let me think. Yeah, I think I was coming out. He was coming in, and we passed each other, and I had seen him from a distance. I knew exactly who he was. And I said, how you doing, Mr. Caan, as I passed him. I didn't stop and ask for an autograph or anything like that. I wasn't going to bother the guy. But he was nice enough. He was kind of caught off guard that somebody knew who he was. And he was nice. He said hello, and we went on our own ways. It's interesting, because I kind of wish I'd seen this interview I saw on YouTube in preparation for tonight's podcast. Because he talks about achieving that level of celebrity where everybody knows you. And he talks about how a lot of celebrities, they complain, they bitch about getting bothered in public when people see them and they want an autograph or a selfie, whatever. Because he's like, you fight your whole life to become famous. You want to be an actor. You want to be a musician. You want that level of fame where everybody knows you. But then when somebody acknowledges you in public, you're going to complain about it? He was such a grounded, down-to-earth guy. And unfortunately, we recently lost him. He passed away. It's interesting when you learn about this guy because he was a very genuine, sincere dude. He lived in Utah, and I know I'd sent you the article, Robbie. He lived in Utah. He lived up near Park City for a while. He wanted to get his kids out of L.A. It wasn't a place to raise his kids. The thing is that once he moved out of L.A., the phone stopped ringing. Like, he wasn't getting the parts and the offers just to continue to work. He went back to L.A.
Oh my God, that's stupid.
Yeah, and I think that's when he did that one television show about casinos. Now, a friend of mine met Kathy Bates in Nebraska. She was filming a movie with Jack Nicholson, and she was shopping, and a friend of mine worked at a department store and saw her and knew that they were filming this production in town and went over and talked to her and said she was the most down-to-earth, wonderful lady and helped her shop for clothes.
Pretty cool. I don't know what I'd do.
I know. I'd shit myself.
I would be an Annie Wilkes and kidnapper.
I know, right? I'm your number one fan. I wonder how many times Kathy Bates has heard that.
I don't know. I mean, how else do you feel about, you do a role and you do it so well that, again, you have these fans, these adoring fans, and hopefully not super crazy ones, but nonetheless, you have all these fans and they continually are so grateful for your performance and your work and the way you did things and portrayed, you know, whatever character you may have portrayed. But to have somebody come up and repeat a line or a phrase, a paragraph, or reenact something, it's a huge honor to know that somebody, for one, went out of their way to witness something that you've done and to either memorize it or to obsess over it, or that it has changed your life so much. And, you know, I feel as though I would understand if there's a celebrity that would find it overwhelming to have that done on a consistent basis, kind of reach a point where you're like, okay, enough. I get it. Thank you so much. It's time to move on. Like, I've done other things or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So I can see how it could, I don't want to say get old or basically just become, you know, nails on a chalkboard at some point where you're like, I know, thank you so much. I thank you. You know,
I'm sure it gets old.
But to hear that, not only James Caan loves his fans and that he said that, but also Kathy Bates is still so humble, because I've met some celebrities, I've worked in some films, very, very background characters, but nonetheless, I've worked close enough to some actors that have no regard for fans. It's a day at the office. They could care less. It's almost annoying. They're bothered, whatever it may be. And I think, would you be feeling that way if you were, you know, working a 9-to-5, miserable? I don't want to say miserable like the rest, like the majority of the United States, or miserable as a lot of people in the world. But nonetheless, you're on a platform to do something that I would think that you would love doing. You would show a little bit more gratitude or show a little bit more passion to your art. I don't know. Of course, I don't know their stories.
Celebrities are human beings. And I know that they have their limits just like the rest of us. You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. These people. And remember when we watched Scream Queen with Mark Patton, when he talks about going to a convention and meeting his fans for that 2 minutes or 5 minutes that they're meeting you, you are Hollywood to that fan.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically a prostitute. You're taking their money. So yeah. Give them something, you know, be kind to these people.
Rewind. And
I think it was really cool that he said that. In that documentary, I was at I was downtown Salt Lake City, and I was with a friend, and we went and we met Nichelle Nichols, and oh. I was dressed up as Spock.
Yes.
How was Nichelle Nichols to you, Robbie?
For one, Michelle, so kind.
She was very nice. She was very nice. Do you remember when she called out to me? Spock!
Yes, Spock! I do. Oh my gosh. I think that photo's downstairs with all my fan memorabilia. Yeah, it's downstairs, darn it. That was incredible.
For that moment, we were her number one fans.
Man.
Do you mind if I put that picture on social media so people can see you and I with Nichelle Nichols?
Please do.
Okay, yeah. Now, and if you're listening to this podcast, make sure you notice that Nichelle Nichols has pretty excellent cleavage. I'm a gay guy, but she's wearing that transparent, like, upper part of the top, and she's showing it all, man. Not all of it, but damn, man, she still had it.
Absolutely. She was incredible. Oh my gosh.
I think she was a little bit turned on as I was dressed up as Spock. Shut the fuck. Yeah.
Whatever.
She wanted me to squeeze her tribbles or trebles or whatever they're called.
You done fucked it up. I'm
not a Star Trek person, man. I'm Star Wars more than Star Trek, okay?
I was so impressed with your costume, your getup. It was incredible. So the fact that when she shouted that out, I was like, oh my God, it worked.
That was really fun. That was really fun. The only other thing I got to talk about real quick. Well, actually I got two things. One is that the movie did really well. Very popular film. In my humble opinion, I would say Misery is the best screen adaptation of any Stephen King novel. And I like several of them. And of course, people would say The Shining. I think Misery is the best one for me. And Kathy Bates got an Oscar for Best Actress from Misery, as well as a Golden Globe Award.
Oh, shit. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. She did really well. And like I said earlier, it changed her whole entire career. It opened up a lot of doors, a lot of parts. There was a period there that I think people wanted her to play in other horror movies, but she went on to do, I think we talked about last time, Fried Green Tomatoes, right?
Oh my Jesus, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck, man. I think that's when I literally started falling in love with her. I thought this woman can do no wrong. Everything that she does is fucking incredible. And then, of course, what I really loved recently is that she joined the cast of American Horror Story as well. Yes. We just talked about, yeah. She has gotten back into that bloody, horror-tinted, creepy thing, and her portrayal of Jesus Christ. Now, she wasn't the real-life Jesus Christ. She was the...
Mel Gibson? She worked for Mel Gibson? God damn, the makeup was incredible when she hung on that cross. I didn't recognize her at all. So.
But when she portrayed the slave-owning, basically, bitch that was targeted and whatever, so on and so forth. She can't do any wrong in my opinion. And I lost my goddamn mind when I saw that she was going to be joining the cast. It's just the best of the best. And she is up there with, again, in my opinion, the best of the best. I absolutely adore her.
She's awesome. She's great. The only other thing I wanted to talk about real briefly is about a year and a half ago, I was lucky enough to acquire the dress that she wore in Misery as Annie Wilkes when she sits down with Paul to have dinner. And Liberace is playing. And Paul had saved up his medication to drug her. But unfortunately, she spills a glass of wine and Paul Sheldon looks devastated. He was going to finally get out of that fucking house. But that dress is actually hanging on the wall in my bedroom. I will post pictures on social media so you can see her flowered print dress that was screen used in that scene.
I don't think you've noticed, but last time I was in Florida, I took that from you. So it's not there anymore.
I know you're lying because I wear it every night, Robbie.
I know when you were under my bed. I knew it. I thought I saw that.
I was wearing it when I had broken into your house and I was your number one fan. I had to dress up as Annie Wilkes. I was underneath your bed. That is true.
My God.
You're gonna start checking under your bed every night. And bullshit. one day you're gonna look under your bed and you're gonna see my face. I'm gonna say, I'm your number one fan.
I'm just gonna keep that fucking 30-pound typewriter handy, just to, you know.
You're gonna need it. What was it? Like a metal doorstopper pig, right? That he also.
It was the and that was it's so good. When I try to. Yeah, I'm excited. I clap my hands. Anyways, the camera is, it's looking at her on top of him and they're wrestling and he's trying to get away and you see that pig and the irony of her pride and joy being that pig, misery. Being the one that fucking kills her. The one that, the thing that basically is her demise is not only, of course, Paul Sheldon being the one that kills her, but he is killing her with her pride and joy that is named Misery.
Yep.
And, or as a statue that is of her pride and joy. And I thought, fuck, man, it couldn't have been written any better. Like, this is full justice. Like, yes.
James Caan, when he did that part, he absolutely, because he was such an active guy, as we talk about the rodeos, him playing football, he was into martial arts. The guy was a very physical guy. He stayed in shape. And when he had to do that part of Paul Sheldon, there was 15 weeks or something that he had to lay in that bed every day for shooting. And that was torture for him as an actor, because he is so physical. But I tell you, the fact that when you listen to the dialogue, when he lights that book on fire with all the answers about misery.
Yep.
And he says, you know, when they finally get into their confrontation and he says, eat it till you choke, you sick, twisted fuck. That was probably the best part of the movie for me, where you have to ride this roller coaster. You see things escalate. You realize that this guy can do nothing. She tortures him. She breaks his ankles. He finally gets his revenge. Just such an intense anger from Paul Sheldon. It's hard not to sit and watch that movie and not get up and scream and shout, fucking finally, you get some revenge. Jesus Christ, you've been through hell, man. You feel so bad for him.
Yeah. It was definitely a sigh of relief. Because that felt like at every corner, he was doing everything he could. Oh. And of course, like, he's just, I mean, he's a celebrity, he's an author, but he's so wanting to be done with this portion of his life and start moving on to something different. So, of course, he's not, like, trained or, of course, you know, character Paul Sheldon is just, he's a writer. He doesn't seem to be the one that goes hiking in the wilderness or takes lessons or does roadie or any of this stuff. He's just this guy that's trying to navigate his captivity. And so at every turn, he continually gets shafted left and right, left and right. So finally, at that moment, I think it was all leading up to this moment where he was, what he said that came out of his mouth, what couldn't have been any more accurate. And it was just finally a breath of relief that he is now, he's finally won. He's finally getting out of this situation.
It's awesome. Just such a great show. Well, this has been episode 15. Robbie and I have talked to you tonight about Misery. If you haven't seen it, well, then there's no fucking point, because we've ruined the entire movie. If you do enjoy it, or if you have seen it, rather, go watch it again, because I hope we've brought up some things that you'll want to revisit that movie and cry for Paul Sheldon, but clap when Kathy Bates gets her death. So. All right. Well, this has been the Gay Florida Man, episode 15. Thank you so much, Robbie, for coming back.
Check
us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Look for those pictures of the dress, and we will see you next time. I'm going to leave you with this. It's really not a prison episode, but I'm going to still say it. I always say it. Be good, and if you can't be good at it. If you're sitting in prison, you're not good at it. Good night, everybody.